Britain is heading for its seventh prime minister in a decade. Where did it all go wrong? Meanwhile, the Democratic Socialists of America made some great leaps in power this week. And Iran is really putting the pressure on Lebanon. This is becoming the key potential sticking point in the entire Iran peace deal. Is this going to split apart the Israel-US alliance? And China is looking at Iran policing the Strait of Hormuz, and it is looking at trying something similar around the island of Taiwan. We'll look at all this and more on today's Trumpet World. Hello and welcome to Trumpet World. I'm coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel. A little ironic given our main story this week comes from the UK. That's right, we have big political drama in the UK, and I immediately flee the country and come to you from Israel. Andrew is our Anglo-America correspondent. Of course, I live in Britain. What happens there directly affects me. So we'll have a bit more of a discussion as we dig into this story. I'm kind of sometimes an outsider's perspective is pretty useful as well in understanding your own politics. So maybe we'll begin by, Andrew, your impressions of watching another British prime minister implode this week.
Yeah, this is, I feel like, a really amazing story. As we mentioned, like, this Tuesday marked the 10-year anniversary of Brexit. So it's amazing how time flies. I still remember, like, staying up late that night. I don't normally follow British elections that close. I just wait till the next day and see what happened. But, like, this Brexit was one where I actually stayed up and watched the polls to, like, see what happened. And that was 10 years ago. And so now this gives us a chance to look back at what the last 10 years since Brexit has been like, and kind of in a sense of almost irony, just hours before we hit the 10-year anniversary of Brexit, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer came out and announced that he would be resigning, which actually makes him the sixth prime minister to resign since Brexit. So 10 divided by 6, and you're looking at an average of less than 2 years per prime minister. Granted, Liz Truss definitely brought down that average quite a bit by only being in there 44 days. But as an American, I mean, we have a different political system here, but I feel like that's just particularly shocking for me because here, our presidents, they serve 4-year terms. Renewable twice, and they usually get renewed. So usually over the course of a decade, we have about one president. If they're bad, they might have two presidents. So here in the United States, over the course of that same 10 years, Donald Trump and Joe Biden have been the only two people to hold that highest office in the nation. Where in Britain, you're now going through having your sixth prime minister resign, even going into your seventh soon. So you'll have had 7 prime ministers in that 10-year period. And so it does give us a chance to be like, well, is this normal? I mean, Britain has a coalition government, so it's definitely possible. But looking back at British history, it's not Italy, which has had like 68 prime ministers since World War II or something like that. They usually stick around a little longer. David Cameron, who's the one who called the Brexit vote, made it 6 years. And so why are we going from having one prime minister who went 6 years to having 6 resign in only 10 years? And so you're looking at historic levels of political turmoil in Britain. Keir Starmer, I guess, just getting back to him, like I said, you know more about his policies than I do, but I definitely did a little bit of research, and that seems like he pretty much single-handedly destroyed the British Labour Party, which has gone from 2 years ago, he won like a historic vote where he didn't need a coalition, just like his party was the most popular party in Britain. And over the past 2 years, not only has Starmer's personal approval ratings fallen 45%, But his party has gone from the most popular in Britain to like the third most popular in Britain. I've got an opinion poll here that's saying they're getting about 18 or 19% support, according to the latest polls. Actually, so the Conservative Party is now more popular than the Labour Party, and it's actually Nigel Farage's Reform Party that's the most popular in Britain at the moment, like 25, 26, 27%, somewhere in that range. Now, I don't think they're up for elections. Like I said, it's a parliamentary system. You vote for parties, not politicians. So the Labour Party just does get to pick who replaces Starmer as the head of the Labour Party. And then they will be the seventh prime minister since Britain, without actually having to call fresh elections right away. But, well, I guess I'll stop for a minute and let you weigh in on why you think his popularity has fallen 45% in 2 years, because obviously a bunch of people thought voting for the Labour Party was a good idea 2 years ago and are now changing their minds.
Yeah, well, first I'll just mention, I think it's been a while since we've had a coalition government. That was David Cameron started out with the coalition government, but I don't know whether we've had one in the last 10 years. It is fairly rare in the UK. But I think what has basically happened in Britain is kind of what would have happened if the Republicans had rejected Donald Trump's nomination and he had gone off and started his own party the way that he threatened to do. Like, I think you've got a similar dynamic in both countries in that you've got a big disconnect between the elites and the people. You know, in America, there's a lot of talk about the uniparty, and it's the same in Britain. And Brexit is just one of those issues. But that, it, you know, 10 years since Brexit, some have said, well, this shows that Brexit's a mistake because no leader has been able to stick around since Brexit. It's all Britain's fault for leaving the European Union. And I kind of completely disagree, but also, like, you know, there is kind of a point there. It's not a coincidence that it's after this Brexit vote, because there's a massive divide between the people and the leadership. You know, Britain voted overwhelmingly, or Britain voted to leave the EU. You know, they passed Brexit in a referendum. If it was up to the politicians, you know, about three quarters of them would have voted to stay. If it was up to the civil service, the kind of the deep state, I bet it would be 90% would have voted to stay. You know, massive difference in opinions between the people and the rulers. And so in America, you had a similar disconnect. Obviously, it wasn't about the European Union. And you had Donald Trump come to power through pressure within the Republican Party. Britain instead had a Conservative Party that stuck with the kind of the uniparty view. And Nigel Farage, you know, there are significant differences between him and Donald Trump. But I think he plays a similar role in British politics. And he's coming at it from the outside. So when the Labour government won the last election, and when Keir Starmer won overwhelmingly, it was kind of a quirk of the electoral system rather than him being massively popular. Like, it was the biggest majority run by the smallest vote section ever. If you looked purely at vote section, like vote percentages, and certainly in terms of like the number of people that voted Labour, like just measure it in the 100,000s. And it would have been a major defeat for them. It was actually much lower than their previous level support. But the right was split between, at that point, Reform Party and the Conservative Party. So Labour was coming first place again in races again and again and again. Whereas if you were to add Conservative and Reform, they would have won overwhelmingly. It was that split that enabled them to come to power. So what it meant is they had a huge majority in Parliament, but no popularity in the nation. And so then as Keir Starmer gets in, people get to know him, he becomes less popular. That very quickly turns into a collapse in support. And at the same time, the election was kind of split between Conservatives and reform. And since then, reform have continued to rise and the conservatives have continued to fall. So the right wing is less split than it was. It's still majorly split, but it's less split than it was. And so you have a swing now that looks like you could, an election would be incredibly unpredictable under these circumstances, but you could see a massive swing, say, to reform with those dynamics. So I think it's more a case of the fracturing of the vote. And Britain is going through a similar process to Germany and some of these other countries, where it always used to be the Conservatives and Labour. The Labour movement kind of got started in the 1920s. So pretty much since 20s, 30s, the Liberals kind of disintegrated as a political force. The left, the Labour became the main party on the left. And it's been Labour and Conservative ever since then. Now, you have Conservative, you have Labour, you have Reform, you have the Green Party. And it has all become very, very fractured. And like I said, a big part of that is, in a democracy, a uniparty just doesn't last. And it has to blow up somehow. Like, you can't have a democracy where the leaders just stick their fingers in their ears and don't listen to any of the people. And, you know, Britain, for example, migration, very similar to what you've had in the United States, where again and again, leaders come to power promising to cut immigration. Opinion polls show that people overwhelmingly want immigration cut, and those leaders don't do anything about it. And in the United States, that led to the rise of Donald Trump, who at least did a good job of putting across the message, hey, I'm actually going to get it done this time. That's a similar thing behind the rise of reform here. So, you know, that I think is one core part of why Starmer's supporters just collapsed so quickly, is it was an illusion in the first place.
Yeah, that's some really good insight. I think what we're seeing in Britain does this comparison between, like, the Donald Trump populist movement against the deep state and the Reform Party uprising against Britain's uniparty. It does highlight why Donald Trump's victory here was so miraculous. With our editor-in-chief, he wrote an article back in 2018 saying that he thought if Donald Trump wasn't elected, it would have been the death of the American Republic. And it's obviously not miraculous for a popular politician to get elected in a democracy. And Donald Trump was a popular politician because of his stances on immigration and other issues. But the miraculous part of it was that this populist movement was actually able to defeat, like, America's deep state, because the people liked Trump, but the media was against him. And the Justice Department was trying to frame him for Russian collusion. There were people trying to, like, get him indicted for felonies he didn't commit and have him arrested. There were, like, corrupt judges appointed from the Obama administration that were actually trying to bar him from even rerunning. And so it took a tremendous amount of courage for Trump to fight all that. And the Supreme Court actually had to intervene on two or three different occasions to rule that he was even allowed to run in the 2020 election. And so without basically just a series of, like, what looked like miraculous events, he would not have been able to get into office. And I feel like, and not that we can take a strong standpoint prophetically as to what's going to happen to Nigel Farage's Reform Party, whether or who's going to be Britain's next prime minister. But you definitely see that that party is up against a lot of the same things. It's currently the most popular party in Britain in that it's got maybe a third of the electorate supporting it. But like I said, both the Conservatives and the Labour Party are against it. And then you've got the civil service against it and the BBC against it. So it's up against what looks like almost near impossible odds to try to actually come to power and implement the reforms, that's what they call it, the Reform Party, that the British people voted for 10 years ago. And so I do think that is a really good analogy, whether reform ends up coming to power or not, of just what the party's up against trying to actually get anywhere, even though it is at least currently more popular than either the Labour or Conservative parties.
And I think some of the deep divisions, again, in both Britain and America, they're behind where we are as well. And that's one of the things we wrote in our August 2016 Trumpet print edition, our kind of our Brexit special. It had Mr. Armstrong's quote where he said, Britain is not going to be part of this European power. That was on the front cover. And I do remember, like, we were working on this article, and I kind of almost felt bad because there was, at least among people I tended to associate with that were pro-Brexit, this wonderful sense of optimism. And it was a bit like the moment when Donald Trump won the election and everyone was rejoicing and Boris Johnson was talking about sunlit uplands and it's all going to be fantastic. And you know, this article said, well, no, it's not. You know, is it sunlit uplands from now on? Sadly, no. While the EU has certainly caused problems for Britain, the biggest wounds are self-inflicted, and we won't go away, and won't go away even when this divorce is finalized. And you know, it goes on to talk about how many of these were problems that came from within Britain. And yeah, it didn't feel good saying that in 2016, but that was the truth the nation needed to hear. And the social division that and the divisions caused by letting in so many migrants, that's already happened. And leaving the EU doesn't fix that. And so you've got this situation now where, yeah, reform is gaining in support, but the Green Party is also gaining in support. I mean, the Green Party is basically, there's the movement in America, isn't there, Queers for Palestine? I'm not sure if that's a real movement or if that's a parody, but that is the Green Party. Like, it's an alliance between the radical left that hold radical left positions on, say, some of these gender issues, and I mean, it's sexual perversion, basically. And then they've been talking a lot about Islam being persecuted, you know, Islamophobia, Britain is Islamophobic, which is an absolute load of nonsense. People that talk about Islamophobia are just people that believe that want blasphemy laws, that don't want you to be able to criticize Islam or Muhammad or anything like that. They want you to be forced to say, Muhammad, peace be upon him. That is exactly the kind of person that talks about Islamophobia. But they're massive at pro-Palestine kind of rallies. And they're also, they have a worryingly high level of popularity, you know, not as high as reform, but that's a substantial number. And a lot of those are migrants. You have a situation where for years, the Labour Party has let in large numbers of migrants because those migrants tend to vote Labour. And you've had places like the Tower Hamlets in London that has allowed all sorts of corrupt voting practices, kind of similar to some of the scandals you see in California. But they've turned a blind eye to them because they benefit Labour. But now you've got a position where Labour can't keep together the coalition that they had before, that these radical Muslims or these immigrants, they've gotten so populous that they don't want to, say, have the compromises that come from voting Labour. They want more extreme positions. Labour can't really follow them into their more extreme positions without losing some of their, say, working class voters in the North. And so they're voting for independent candidates. They're voting for the Green Party. You had a convicted terrorist win election in Birmingham recently. So how do you solve those kind of divisions? Like, once you've let in enough migrants that they can start having that kind of impact on the political system, this becomes very, very hard to solve. That in turn has actually led to that split in the Reform Party, because you now have the Restore Party by Rupert Lowe that has come along and advocated for re-immigration, like the idea we've got to take British passports off some of these people and get them out of here. That's the only way we restore Britain, which I have a fair bit of sympathy with. But at the same time, Rupert Lowe has also ironically embraced some of the same anti-Semitism that is gaining traction on the left, which is just abhorrent. So, it's a whole very messy situation. But my point is just this, it's the messy political situation is a symptom of a very, very divided Britain. And I think you can have two parties and have stable leadership between the two, because there's a fair bit they have in common. Okay, they might disagree on a lot of things, but there's still a lot that they have in common. I mean, you look back on, say, Gladstone and Disraeli, probably the most famous duo in British history, leaders of rival powers who kind of opposed each other very strongly, but it's very easy to look back on them now and admire them both. I mean, I tend to support Disraeli out of the two, but I see a lot of great characteristics in Gladstone, because they have a lot in common. So you can have a political party divided by two ways and have robust debate and things like that. But I think the fact that we now have four or five parties is a symptom that a lot of those underlying assumptions behind British politics that you would just take for granted, that Britain should be a prosperous, free state, that traditional British values, these are no longer things that these different parties have in common. So it's a symptom of a deep, deep societal sickness.
Yeah, and I think one statistic I read this morning was that while Reform is currently the most popular party in Britain, and the Greens are the fourth most popular party, the Greens are actually the most popular party amongst those under age 50. You've got a generational divide, too, with the older generation gravitating towards Reform, the younger generation gravitating towards the Greens. And when I've seen divides like this here in America and in other nations, Germany and whatnot, oftentimes what you see is the mainstream parties, Labour and Conservative, need to start changing their own platforms to attract voters. Making a choice is like, well, if Reform's the most popular over age 50 and the Greens are most popular under age 50, we either need to start becoming more like Reform or more like the Greens in order to attract new voters. And I think there's some indication that the Labour Party may have already made that choice and decided to actually start shifting its own platform, not more populist or not more Reform, but actually more further to the left, to try to like win back some of those under age 50-year-olds that have decided to go over to the Greens.
Yes, that is a key part of his position. I think his fundamental belief is if he can unite the left, if he can shift left and bring in the Greens without alienating too many people, while the right remains split between Conservative and Reform, he'll win the next election. That's the political calculus. And I think that is kind of like Andy Burnham is one of those politicians that I'm not sure if he has too many fixed principles and will make that calculation. But I think his calculation is a much further left position is the key to success. And so Andy Burnham, he is basically the anointed successor of Keir Starmer. There's a little element of Isaiah 3, you have clothes, you be our ruler, where nobody really wants the job, a prophesied state that Britain would reach there with a situation where apparently Andy Burnham wants the job, but he wants it in September. And Keir Starmer was like, well, you tried pushing me out. I'm going now. You've got to be ready to take over in a couple of weeks. But that's the state of play now, where nobody whoever leads the Labour Party is the Prime Minister, because the Labour Party has the most seats in Parliament. And Burnham, enough people have come out in support of him that nobody's challenging him. He is going to be the next leader of the Labour Party. He is going to be Britain's next prime minister. I'm curious, for someone from the US, Andrew, had you heard of Andy Burnham before this week?
I had not.
Yeah, he doesn't have, internationally, he doesn't have a big position. Like, he's never held a big international position. His choice of foreign minister would be interesting. I imagine he'll stick with someone like Yvette Cooper, or someone who's done the job before. He's got the nickname the King of the North over here, but it's because of his role as mayor of Manchester. That's where he's been serving for quite a while. I mean, obviously, the mayor of Manchester doesn't have the same international clout as, say, the mayor of London and someone like Sadiq Khan has. But it's enabled him to build up a lot of political support in the north of England. So he's set to take over, and he's set to bring Britain in a much more left-wing direction. And I think one potential here is much more kind of communist-style intervention in the economy. Because another big part, I think, of the British political crisis is when you borrow a whole lot of money, and the proverbs say that a borrower is servant to the lender. And Britain's debt has been growing faster, I think, what's the statistic? Faster than any country other than Botswana. So a horrendous level of debt. And it's kind of reached the point where it's hard to borrow more. We've run out of other people's money. So whether you can be successful as a leader depends on what the financial markets think of your policies. If they think your policies are going to increase Britain's debt, then they'll vote you out of office. Doesn't matter whether those policies are good or bad necessarily. And I think, for example, Liz Truss, in the long run, her policies may well have reduced Britain's debt. However, she front-loaded the tax cuts. She wanted to put that first. In the short term, definitely that would increase debt. Investors didn't like it. She was fired. You know, investors, bondholders, they're the real boss. And so you can go from Conservative to Labour, but there's still only a limited number of things they can do. The bondholders are the real boss. There's one way of fixing this is really trying to deal with the debt. Andy Burnham, some of his talk, that you could see the potential for the nation to come in, for like the government to try and take over bits of the financial market, to say, try and force pension funds to invest in bonds, to unilaterally cut the debt, you know, to take some pretty radical steps to try and force the bond market into line. And Andy Burnham has talked potentially about doing that. For a Labour Party that wants to spend more, that is going to be a major temptation. And that, I think, would be the final nail in the coffin in Britain's economy. But I think that does bring us to this point of ultimately, why is Britain in this position? And it is because the nation is being cursed. It's being cursed with social divisions, and a lot of that is the result of our own behavior, you know, migration for one, cursed with poor productivity, poor growth, poor income. And again, a lot of that is our own self-inflicted disasters. Britain spent a huge, like vast sums of money during COVID, for example, paying people to stay at home and not work. And that's a big part of the reason we're in the position that we are today. So we're causing our own problems, but the nation is being cursed. And then we're seeing a nation flailing around, trying to deal with the curses, going for radical solutions, divided as to which direction to go in. The only solution is repentance. And that's how Mr. Stephen Fleury concluded his article on this. Brexit plus 10 years equals 6 PMs. He quoted 2 Chronicles 7 and verse 14. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, will forgive their sin, and will heal their land. That's the solution. And Mr. Fleury concludes his article, if Britain will not repent nationally, the Bible makes plain this course ends in the Great Tribulation. But you can repent individually. Do not be lulled to sleep. Don't ignore the problems. The signs are there with those for eyes to see. Britain needs to repent towards the only leader who can truly govern it and lead it to safety, power, peace, and purpose. That's the solution to Britain. But I think this issue of shifting left, it does tie into our main story from the United States this week, and that is the results from these New York primary elections, where for several districts in Congress, in New York, they always vote Democrat. So the primary elections, the question of who is going to be the Democratic candidate is more important, really, than the main election in November, because it's always going to be that Democratic candidate that will win the November election. And in these primaries, candidates backed by the Democratic Socialists of America have done really well. So we've seen Andy Burnham kind of do well in Britain, shifting to the left. And it looks like we've got a pretty similar dynamic now in the United States, right?
Yeah, or definitely. I don't know if this is evidence that the electorate as a whole is shifting left. I'll get into that in a minute. But it's definitely evidence that the Democratic Party itself is shifting left. Now, there is a small political party in the United States called the Democratic Socialist of America, which is overtly socialist. The Democratic Party itself oftentimes, it espouses socialist principles, but a lot of Democrats still try to distance themselves from the socialist label because it's not necessarily popular amongst independent voters. But the Democratic Socialist of America, it's a small party that figured out a long time ago that rather than run its own politicians and candidates, it's easier to endorse and support far-left Democrats. So it's like they're not trying to compete with the Democrats like the Republicans do. They're trying to hijack the Democratic Party. And right now, probably about 14% of Democrats in Congress are at least aligned with the Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is aligned with the Democratic Socialist of America. So the Democratic Socialist of America, they're endorsing candidates across the nation. They had a big victory several months ago when they got a Muslim man, Zohran Mandani, who's also a Democratic Socialist, to win, become the mayor of New York City. They're kind of trying to position Mandani like the new face of the Democratic Party. He's still new in office, but quite popular in New York. So he endorsed a number of congressional representatives in the Democratic primary to try to get them into Congress. Particular here, he's got three names: Brad Lander, Claire Valdez, and Avila Chevalier. So these are Democratic Socialist aligned politicians. The Chevalier woman, she actually, we had a write-up at the Trumpet on her a few weeks back where CNN went back through like her deleted social media post where she's overtly saying the state of Israel should not exist, the police should not exist, the U.S. border should not exist, and private property should not exist. There was even one post where she said she identifies as a communist, but she's still fascinated by the pyromania that comes with anarchism. So, as radical as you could get, like Bolshevik levels of radicalism, not just for amnesty for illegal immigrants, but like the fact that there should not be a U.S.-Mexico border. You shouldn't even be allowed to own property. And so, straight up communist. Like the other two candidates, she's very anti-Israel. And I think that has a big part of why she did well, or actually all three of these candidates did well, is since the war between Israel and Iran, there's been an uptick in like anti-Israel sentiment in America amongst both conservatives and liberals. And so the Democrats, they're really trying to ride this anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic upswell to gain popularity. So between their anti-Israel positions and their endorsement by Mandani, these three radical democratic socialist unseated three more moderate Democrats in the primaries. This isn't the actual election. The election comes in November, midterm elections. But because New York has been such a Democrat stronghold for over 100 years, it's pretty much a given that whoever the Democrat candidate's going to win. That's not even really a question anymore. The Democrat will beat the Republican in New York City. So the primary was interesting. It's like, okay, is this going to be like a more old school Democrat who's for a bunch of social welfare programs, but still says that Israel's a normal nation like any other nation that has a right to exist? Or is this going to be one of the radical Democrats that say Israel has no right to exist, private property has no right to exist, the border has no right to exist? And that's definitely what we saw, as the whole Mamdani wing of the party just dominated these primaries. And so this highlights the Democratic Party's shift to the far left. Now, interesting dynamic overall is looking at the last couple of presidential elections here in the United States. I think the Democratic Party's shift to the far left is one of the root causes behind Donald Trump's victory. Even people like Elon Musk have said as much. He did an interview with Donald Trump before the last election, where Elon came out and said, he's like, I voted for Barack Obama twice. I voted for Hillary Clinton. He's like, I consider myself a center leftist. I still consider myself a center leftist. He said, but the Democratic Party under Biden has gone like so far Marxist left that any center leftist in America who actually want the border to exist and want some policies that allow businesses to thrive are almost forced to support Donald Trump, even if he's not their ideal candidate, because the option's basically Donald Trump or communism. And so I do think this shift in New York, I guess we'll get the data during the midterms, may end up driving more independent voters to the Republicans as the Democratic Party gets more and more radical. So I don't think there's a huge risk that we're going to see, a communist president in the United States in the short term. But these more radical Democrats, even though they're hurting their party's popularity, they've got people who are like putting posts on social media that says, I'm fascinated by the pyromania associated with anarchism. Basically saying that, like, we need to start burning stuff down. Like, that's, the Bolsheviks didn't take over Russia in an election. They took over Russia in a 10-year civil war. Killed about 10% of the Russian population, probably the bloodiest civil war in human history. And so I feel like you're seeing that shift in the Democratic Party. It's almost a rebellion in the Democratic Party against the Barack Obama strategy. Barack Obama, and this is one reason that in America Under Attack, Mr. Gerald Flory identified him as an Antiochus figure, is Antiochus Epiphanes was a man who, famous for his silver tongue, famous for his flatteries, famous for pretending he was someone he's not, dressed like a Roman, took on Roman mannerisms in order to just like ingratiate him to Rome when he had an alternative agenda. Barack Obama was very good at pretending like he was a center leftist while acting like a radical. So good that like Elon Musk voted for him twice. And then when the mask kind of came off during the Biden administration, started having second thoughts. And so you're seeing like these three candidates who just got elected in New York, they're not following the Barack Obama strategy of pretending to be more moderate than they are. They're publicly calling for, we shouldn't have a border. Israel should not exist. The police should not exist. The communists have a lot of good points. And so I feel like the big prophetic takeaway from this story is, prophetically, there's not, the prophecies aren't about like an eventual communist takeover of the United States. The prophecies are about a civil war in the United States. Getting back to that point you made earlier, like a civil war where things get so bad that no one even wants to be, like, you have clothing, be our ruler. The Isaiah 3, no one even wants the job. And so on that level, like I said, there are similarities between this New York story and what's happening in Britain, both where you've got your mainstream left party, the Democrats and the Labor Party, going further left. In the United States, even like going so far left that you're endorsing political violence in order to like gain power that you can't get through elections. And it'll be interesting to see what data comes through the midterm elections this year. Even interesting to see how this situation plays out in Britain. The situation might be a little different there. Like you said, the Burnham's political calculus is that he can unite the left while the right remains divided between conservative and reform, he can gain power. But as you're finding out in America, if you go too far left, you start driving independence to the conservative movement. So I feel like Mondani, by being more overt than Obama was, is actually helping the Donald Trump resurgence, driving more independents, driving more people like Elon Musk to the conservatives, while at the same time pushing the left from just being a liberal political party to an actually violent Marxist force.
Yeah, that's a good point about the danger behind a lot of this movements and a lot of these movements and what they can do to these countries. So some very radical movements rising up in both, I think partly due to migration. You've got similar dynamics in New York with immigrants siding with Islamist type leaders or people that have very anti-Israel positions. But it's not just migration. I think it's the same for the Green Party. There are plenty of people at home, or too many at least, that are willing to go along with some of these extreme positions. And you know, the Bible warns us about the coming unrest that is coming within the United States and elsewhere. What else do you have for us, Andrew, from the Anglo-America regions? We just finish this up.
Yeah, well, three other quick stories. We mentioned briefly earlier about the Supreme Court having a role in bringing Donald Trump back to power. They're continuing to support his efforts to enforce the rule of law in America. They actually made three big Supreme Court decisions this week, all regarding to immigration. One saying that the Trump administration does not actually have to let immigrants cross the American border to apply for asylum. Before, they said the immigrants would cross the American border, apply for asylum, and then get put on a waiting list and wait in America. The Trump administration said, is like, well, no, we're only accepting so many asylum applications a day, and you can sit and wait in Mexico until it's your turn. You can't just come to the United States and wait for 7 years till you get an asylum hearing. A lower court had tried to make them do that, let them in the United States, let them wait here for many years before they get their hearing. Now the Supreme Court says, like, they don't have to do that. You can make them wait in Mexico. And if they don't want to wait for 7 years at the Mexican border, then they can just go home. Another court case saying that some particular ethnicities, let me look up the exact ethnicities, like Syrians and Afghans, don't actually have protected status in the United States. In that, like, they don't have a right to apply for asylum. Like, they're just like any other nation. Under the Biden administration, we'd give some of these Middle Eastern ethnicities, like, oh, you've got, like, an expedited asylum process, which has been done away with. And then even a third ruling that says even, like, green card holders who leave the nation and come back can be denied entry if they've committed, like, a major morally reprehensible crime. And so three big court cases that are basically just helping Donald Trump just stem this huge influx of illegal immigration that's taken over the nation for the past many years. Also, some big stories about just the level of fraud in the American health system. Actually finding America spends $1.8 trillion on healthcare each year, making it our biggest budget item, more than defense, more than Social Security, more than interest, more than anything. And now we're actually finding up to $6.5 billion in false claims. Highlighting some of the work that Elon Musk started and wasn't able to finish in the DOGE program about just the amount of spending in America that's fraudulent. And yet you can't get rid of it just because of, like, the sickness and corruption in the U.S. government. And then one final one, bringing some financial news a little closer to home, is the U.S. household personal savings rate has fallen to its lowest level since 2022, with the average American household only saving 2.6% of its after-tax income. A big problem in that they also say that, like, 30 to 50% of American households don't even have $1,000 in emergency savings. Like, if you needed a new transmission for your car, you'd have to put it on a credit card because you don't have the savings, nor are you even actively building up your savings because your credit card already has so much money on it. Something that's got some financial investors in America worried that during our next economic downturn, the recession that results from that will be a lot worse, considering Americans don't have much savings, and gives a chance for you personally to get your own copy of our Solve Your Money Troubles book, which definitely, using wisdom from the Book of Proverbs, recommends you have not just $1,000 in emergency savings, but 3 to 6 months of emergency savings. And if you're one of the half of Americans who don't even have $1,000 in savings and you want to get that 3 to 6 months emergency savings, the book recommends not setting aside 2.6% of your after-tax income, but 5% of your after-tax income in order to try to get that savings as soon as possible, which for many Americans these days is going to involve going out to restaurants less, driving a cheaper car, some effort to, like, reduce your standard of living so that you've actually got a safety net and some financial security. So that book, Solve Your Money Troubles, it goes through the Book of Proverbs, and it's not just financial principles we made up. It's all based on the Bible, a lot of it from King Solomon, the wisest person to ever live other than Jesus Christ. Just giving some very practical wisdom that if more Americans were following, investors would not be nearly as concerned as they are about what's going to happen to the nation the next recession that hits, because people's credit cards are maxed out and they don't actually have any money in the bank.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew. Another big story just for the world this week, another big story for the economy all revolves around, well, what happens with the Strait of Hormuz? Does the oil still flow? And Iran has kind of done a fantastic job for it of linking what happens in Hormuz with Lebanon and Israel's attempts to try and deal with the terrorist group Hezbollah. And the way that they have done this now looks to be really driving a wedge between the Trump administration and Israel and Benjamin Netanyahu. This could end up being quite a dramatic story. So to tell us about it, we'll go to our Middle East correspondent, Mihailo Zekic.
Yes, on June 22nd, Pakistan and Qatar, the two mediators between Iran and the United States, announced the formation of a deconfliction cell in Lebanon, containing both those two countries, the United States, Iran, and Lebanon itself. What is a deconfliction cell? That's not usually in most people's parlances. Well, it's a formal diplomatic term meaning a line of communication between two indirect parties in a war to make sure they don't hit each other. Like, for example, Israel and Russia had a deconfliction cell in Syria during the Syrian civil war. Russia supported the Syrian government. Israel didn't like a lot of what they were doing. So there were two sides in that conflict, but neither Russia nor Israel wanted to go to war with each other. So it was basically a line to say, I'm planning on doing something here. I know you don't like it, but give your guys time to get out of the way before we hit your proxy. What's the big elephant in the room of this deal? Well, the cell is supposed to govern the conflict in Lebanon. Israel is the main party to that conflict that is not invited to this cell. And the United States, from what we can tell, established this cell without consulting Israel, without giving Israel advance notice, and is basically a diktat, you could say, that we're forming this oversight group with all of your enemies, with Iran, with Qatar, with the Lebanese government, that's not including you. And we're going to make decisions, internationally recognized agreements, through this forum that will impact you and that will impact what you can do and what you can't do, and you don't have a say in it. I just read this morning, actually while you and Andrew were talking, a news flash came up saying more details on how this cell is going to function, and it's going to be headquartered in Doha, Qatar, a country that has tried to undermine Israel through sponsoring terror groups like Hamas for a long time. And it will feature representatives of U.S. Central Command, the branch of the military overseeing the Middle East, with the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of Iran, which is technically a recognized terror group by the U.S. government. This terror arm of the Iranians will share an office with the United States military. You can imagine a lot of people in Israel are not too happy about this, but the reason this is happening is because the U.S. isn't happy with Israel. They see what Israel's doing against Hezbollah, Iran's proxy in Lebanon, as undermining the peace deal. And Iran has threatened two or three times that if you don't stop Israel from destroying Hezbollah, we're just going to walk away from negotiations. All the deals are off. We're back to war. And President Trump here is taking the side of Iran, saying, okay, we want them to be on the table. We're going to put Israel in its place.
What are the chances of maybe the most dramatic kind of possible outcome of this, which is you have U.S. troops in Lebanon to protect Hezbollah from Israel?
Well, the actual text of the agreement isn't publicly available, but from what we can tell, this isn't like a mutual defense clause or anything like that. This is, again, like, say, what Israel and Russia had in the Syrian civil war. America had a similar one with Russia, too. This is more of a forum to be speaking with each other. It's like the so-called hotline that the White House has with the Kremlin, that you could get them on the phone anytime you want, at least historically.
Right, and I'm not asking if this agreement would make that happen. But I'm asking, are we moving in that direction? Because we are having Iran successfully linking Hamas to Lebanon. They're repeatedly telling America, hey, it's all Israel's fault. America is telling Israel, stop. America in general, Israel is not stopping. Could we get to that point where you kind of almost have America and Israel on opposite sides of a conflict?
I highly, highly doubt that. You have to remember, still a large portion of President Trump's electorate segment still supports Israel quite heavily. There's obviously a lot of American Jews who are still registered voters living in Israel. And if he were to do something as dramatic as that, he and everybody involved with him would tarnish his legacy with that wing of the Republican Party for time immemorial. But with that being said, you don't need boots on the ground facing against Israel to do a lot of damage to Israel. You don't necessarily need your boots on the ground for this. If my guess would be the worst case scenario of not necessarily this system, but the trend that we're seeing is that the U.S. greenlights a new peacekeeping operation from other countries, from places like Europe or Latin America, or even the Muslim world itself, to organize and face off against Israel. There technically already is one called UNIFIL, which you don't hear about them on the news for a reason. They're very ineffective at doing what they're supposed to do. But the U.S., if push came to shove, and if it wanted to keep going down this route of organizing new international forums, sidelining Israel to pressure Israel to stand down, that's probably the most likely option.
Where is this divide between Israel and America leading?
Well, yes, in the trumpet, we obviously focus on what Bible prophecy has to say with world events, and there are a couple of prophecies that come to mind specifically about this. Isaiah 9:21, Zechariah 11, verse 14, speak of one of the curses of the end time nations of Israel, as you mentioned on your segment with Andrew. That includes Britain, that includes the United States, but it also includes the state of Israel itself, or the tribe of Judah, as it's known in Bible history and prophecy. And according to those verses, one of the curses would be the brotherhood between those countries would be broken, specifically the other tribes against Judah. And when this Iran war started, it looked to a lot of outside observers, there's American and Israeli pilots flying together into the heart of danger, unprecedented coordination, unprecedented talk between President Trump and Prime Minister Netanyahu. And we were saying that this could end up breaking the alliance worse than what it was before they came in. And that looks exactly like what this is happening. Another prophecy in Hosea 5:13, as Mr. Fleury explains in Jerusalem in Prophecy, his free booklet, shows that eventually Israel's going to turn to Germany to take care of its security problems, that its problems with Islamic extremism, in Hosea's case, that's specifically about the Palestinians, but Israel doesn't trust the United States anymore. Israel goes shopping around for a new security guarantee, and this collapse between these two countries, this breach of trust, certainly will play a big part into it. And one thing to note about that is, okay, Israel's a bit used to this from, say, Democratic presidents, whether they were as anti-American as Barack Obama, or whether they were as anti-Israel as Barack Obama, or perhaps slightly more moderate in terms of people like Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter. They knew that, okay, we'll just ride out the wave until a Republican comes in, and then we can get a little bit more buoyancy there. President Trump, especially in his first term, people call him the most pro-Israel president that has ever been in the White House, and he's still doing this kind of stuff. And not just the Israeli government, but there's probably a lot of people in Israel itself looking at this and going, if this is the most pro-Israel president we could expect, then we could never expect another pro-Israel president, one way or the other, from either party to be in the White House again. Especially when you see rising levels of anti-Semitism, not just on the left, as Andrew was talking about, but among the isolationist right as well. And if these trends keep up, Israel's going to see there's no point on waiting for the next guy to come into the White House anymore. We're just going to have to abandon ship and find a completely different system.
Well, thank you for that story, Mihailo. Anything else from the Middle East this week?
Yes, you mentioned about Iran's shenanigans in the Strait of Hormuz. The Wall Street Journal reported yesterday that Iran, between the transit fees, between some of these other financial mechanisms, the Iranian government is expecting a windfall of $40 billion a year from these new operations they're planning on implementing in the Strait of Hormuz. We'll see if that actually comes into reality. But you could see, with President Trump backing down, with Israel being forced to back down, Iran may be battered, but they're expecting some really positive outcomes to come from all these negotiations. And one other one, also on Wednesday, President Trump had a conference with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte in Washington, and the subject of Turkey came up. Turkey's a NATO member. It's the only NATO member in the Middle East. It's hosting a NATO summit soon. And this is what President Trump said about Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the leader there. Quote, "And he stayed out of the war, you know. He might have been a very strong candidate on the Iran side, because, as you know, he's not a big fan of Israel, and I asked him to stay out, and he did stay out," end quote. If we're to take this at face value, the U.S. government had strong reasons to believe Turkey was going to join the war on Iran's side, attacking Israel. Turkey has not been a friend of Israel for a long time, but this would have been a dramatic escalation, and it looks like, if this is any telling sign, we could expect dramatic escalations like this coming down the road, which is exactly what Bible prophecy tells us to expect eventually.
Well, thank you for that, Mihailo. As he just mentioned, Iran's piracy in the Strait of Hormuz, or their warfare, or whatever you want to call it, their frequent interruptions of trade and shooting on ships has certainly shown the power of grabbing a patch of real estate in the ocean, particularly if it is on a crucial choke point. We're also seeing China grab a piece of real estate in the ocean. To tell us about this and what this means, we'll go to our Asia correspondent, Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, that's right. The Chinese Communist Party has launched a new campaign targeting commercial shipping off of Taiwan's Pacific coast. So this is an area that China has no jurisdiction over. These are international waters. But in this new campaign, Chinese Coast Guard vessels are approaching these commercial ships and basically interrogating them via radio and issuing orders to them and just asserting kind of a right to conduct law enforcement, even though these waters are supposed to be open to free navigation. So far, almost 200 commercial vessels have been harassed in this way, according to a new report this week in the Wall Street Journal. And this is drawing a lot of criticism from the nations whose vessels are being harassed. The U.S.'s de facto embassy in Taiwan called China's actions, quote, deeply destabilizing, and called on the Chinese to end this campaign. We also saw a joint statement this week issued by the British, French, and German authorities. They said that the Chinese operations, quote, threaten regional stability and the freedom of navigation and safety of international shipping. End quote. So China's behavior here, it is very brazen and it has drawn some sharp rebukes, but nothing beyond that. Just some strongly worded statements. And analysts worry that this behavior is setting a precedent that China could build on as it works to assert more and more control over these waters near Taiwan and really waters throughout the South China Sea. Raymond Powell is one of those analysts. He is the director of the Sea Light Project at Stanford University. And he said, quote, "Today it's radio challenges, but that lays the groundwork for tomorrow, when it could be stopping and boarding ships, redirecting them to clear customs on the mainland, or turning them back for failing inspections," end quote. So there is some real potential here for escalation. This could be something that China is able to, you know, build on and escalate from. And Raymond Powell says that the fact that the only thing the U.S. did was issue a statement about this does not bode well for Taiwan's independence. He said, quote, "Words not backed by real costs just teach Beijing that its strategy is working. The coils will keep on tightening." End quote. So the coils will keep on tightening, he says, since the U.S. is not really standing up to China's efforts to police these waters near Taiwan and standing up to, you know, China's efforts to just bring Taiwan under its control. And it is true that we've seen a disturbing trend with the Trump administration in recent months just being so desperate to keep trade flowing with China that they are willing to compromise on defending Taiwan. Last month, President Trump even delayed an arms package that Taiwan ordered from the United States. This was a major arms package worth $14 billion. And President Trump has delayed its delivery and maybe canceling it altogether just in order to avoid upsetting China so that U.S.-China trade can keep on flowing. And we even heard Mr. Trump refer to that arms package as a, quote, "very good negotiation chip" with China. So it should be no surprise to see that with this new Chinese harassment campaign, the U.S. has limited its response just to a statement. And this is a trend that the Trumpet keeps a close eye on, because our editor-in-chief has warned for decades now that America's lack of will is going to be the main factor that enables China to eventually seize Taiwan. He began warning about that all the way back in 1998, after U.S. President Bill Clinton had yielded to Chinese pressure and had issued a statement that was critical of Taiwanese independence. At that time, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury wrote, "America has showcased its broken will to the whole world. How could anyone fail to see that Taiwan is destined to become a part of mainland China? These 23 million people are going to be forced into the Chinese mold, and it's going to happen for one reason, because of a pitifully weak-willed America. Does freedom really mean so little to us?" End quote. And then Mr. Fleury also explains that his understanding of the whole U.S.-China-Taiwan dynamic is built on Bible prophecy. Specifically, it's a passage in Leviticus 26 saying that if the people of the United States, modern-day Israel, fail to turn to God, then he would, quote, "break the pride of their power." So as we see China today intensifying its drive to conquer Taiwan, and as we see America limiting its response to just statements of concern and even withholding arms sales to Taiwan, in all of these developments, we can see how Taiwan's independence will soon be one of the casualties of America's broken will. And we have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy. It takes a close look at the whole U.S.-China-Taiwan dynamic. It puts it all in the context of biblical prophecy. So for anyone interested in that, I hope that you'll pick up a copy of that booklet. Again, it's called Russia and China in Prophecy.
Thank you for that, Jeremiah. Now, obviously, what happens around Taiwan, this has global implications. This is about if China is able to grab a country effectively that looks to America to keep it safe, well, that has massive repercussions for any country anywhere that looks to America to keep it safe, and any country that wants to fundamentally change the American world order and wants to take over countries that America keeps safe. So this has global ramifications in that respect. I'm curious, though, does asserting its control over some of these waters and patrolling these waters, does that affect other countries? Is there a large volume of shipping, say, going towards Japan that goes through this area? Are there kind of some of the freedom of navigation implications, say, for this that you also have for Hormuz? Or is this purely a Taiwan kind of story?
Well, yes, these are, it's an international shipping lane that is used quite a bit for shipments to and from Japan, as you mentioned there, also the Korean Peninsula and some other nations. So they're heavily trafficked shipping lanes, and that's why we saw the statements from the British, the Germans, the French. You know, this is an area that is used by many nations. And so it is China trying to tighten its grip over an area that's supposed to be open to free navigation, an area that is important for global commerce and for freedom of you know, operations there. So they're trying to show the world that they can and should be able to have dominance over this region. And unless we push back against that, they'll be expanding that sort of effort to enforce Chinese authority further and further from their coasts all the time, I think.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. What else do you have for us from Asia this week?
Yes, first up, a story about a new Chinese supercomputer called LineChine. This was built in Shenzhen, China, and it has dethroned the world's fastest supercomputer, which was in the United States. So now this Chinese supercomputer, LineChine, it is the world's fastest, and that's a title that China has not held since 2017. And LineChine can perform more than 2 quintillion calculations per second. So just a stunningly powerful machine that is optimized for finding medical breakthroughs and performing virtual weapons tests and even nuclear explosion simulations and things like that. And with China now at the top of the supercomputer list, it's clear that its technological prowess is rapidly advancing. And then one final story here about Russian forces in Ukraine. Over the last week or so, they have pushed into the city of Kostyantynivka in eastern Ukraine, and they're now trying to surround this strategic city. The Institute for the Study of War has some really good coverage on this, and Kostyantynivka is viewed as a gateway to the rest of the Donbass, since Russian forces could use footholds there to push further west toward the cities of Kramatorsk and Slovyansk, which are really the last real strongholds that Ukraine has in the Donbass region. So it's too early to say for sure if that will happen. And we know that Russia is also suffering some serious setbacks in the war right now. But the infiltration of this key city shows that Russian President Vladimir Putin is not defeated. He remains, you know, just viciously determined to conquer Ukraine. And this could be a bit of a breakthrough that he's approaching here. But whatever the outcome of this conflict is, Bible prophecy shows us that Putin will eventually be leading a vast Asian military that will wage wars far larger than this current one.
Well, thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. And thank you to all of our panelists this week. Thank you to Mr. Matthew Friesen for engineering and production. I'll leave you with one piece of literature. We talked a lot about politics at the start and the dissent, the political crisis in Britain, similar issues in the United States. Our book, America Under Attack. We don't talk about that quite as much as we used to on this show, but that is your guide, really, to understand what is happening in both of these countries. I mean, I've made this point before, but America's in the title. A lot of it focuses on America. There's a lot in there for other countries, too, though. It is the critical guide to understanding the spiritual dimension behind politics. So you can get that for free on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can read it online. We can send you a free print copy. We'd be very happy to do that. We will be back next week with our regular Wednesday show. If you have any questions, any comments, you can get in touch at trumpetworld@thetrumpet.com. And until next week, keep watching your world.